Okay.
So I was trying to summarize my friend Heinz Hammond, who teaches at Villanova, to send me a reading list on American libel law. And one of the articles he sent me was a collection of responses to a book called The Unwanted Dream by Professor Jeffrey Rosen, which I read, and I said, wow, that really totally opened up this whole realm. And so as I tried to think of who could give a survey of American law as a parallel to what we were discussing, so I was talking with him, we came up with all sorts of ideas, and I said, well, why don't I just email Professor Rosen and ask him who he'd recommend? And he was kind enough to recommend himself. I said that if you would be interested in coming yourself, you know, I was very, very happy that he was. And so I'm very, very pleased to have Professor Rosen here. Regrettably, we didn't bring copies of Unwanted Gaze and Fido Autograph. but you can send it to him. You can send it to him later, but that's better than your question.
I was absolutely delighted when Rabbi Klapper wrote, both because the question of privacy, gossip, and American law has been a long-standing interest of mine, and because the comparison between American and Talmudic law is a new interest of mine. I'm a novice to this area, but increasingly interested in the similarities and differences between the approach of the Talmud and the American Constitution, and I'm very much looking forward to learning from you. I can tell from the morning's discussion that this is an extremely informed, engaged, and remarkably able group, and you can teach me far more about the subject than I know about it, which is on the Talmudic side thing. But I'd love to give a brief introduction to the differences between the Talmudic and the American approaches to questions of truthful gossip, as I understand it. And then perhaps we can talk about some more recent and practical experiences with the subject that I've had that I'd like your thoughts about. So the question of how American law deals with gossip, as you know, I'm sure, inspired the most famous article on the right to privacy ever written in 1890 by Louis Brandeis, the future Supreme Court Justice, who in the Harvard Law Review lamented the fact that the details of sexual relations, as he put it, were being broadcast from the columns of the daily papers. Column of idle gossip is being what used to be shouted is now shouted from the rooftops. The precise gossip item that provoked Brandeis's polemic is disputed, but some scholars think that it was a mild gossip item in a Boston tabloid that described the wedding breakfast that Brandeis's law partner, Charles Warren, had put on for his daughter's wedding. Others point out that the daughter wasn't married to Wage at the time, so perhaps the item may have been referring to something else, but it was essentially a fairly mild description of the private lives of aristocrats that inspired Brandeis's screed. And from this we have a sense that privacy law in its original American incarnation was designed to protect aristocrats from being gossiped about by means of a new technology, namely the tabloid newspaper and the Kodak camera. And it was these two new technologies that Brandeis and Warren worried would make it increasingly difficult for high-status people to conceal their private affairs from the idle gossip of the world. Brandeis tried to propose a legal remedy for the dignitary invasion that he thought stems from this invasive technology, but he struggled to do so because American law has never, as Brandeis recognized, taken cognizance of offenses against honor. Mere consumerism, he said, is something that Roman law is very good at describing, something that European law is centrally concerned about because of its hierarchical tradition, which allowed people to demand the respect that those of their status would do. So in Europe, aristocrats could demand a certain amount of respect. If they're insulted by a social inferior, then they would cane them with a stick, choosing the wood of the stick to signify the precise social status of the person who insulted them. If they're insulted by a social equal, they challenge them to a duel. But for this dignitary system to work, you need a society where everyone knows their place. In America, designed to deny that practice, it was harder to enforce dignitary norms. For that reason, Brandeis proposed a new series of torts, the Brandeis torts, which sound like a delicious dessert, that is about confusing our area of law. They include intrusion on seclusion, intentional infliction of emotional distress, false light. These torts had a rather checkered history in the 20th century because all of them depend on some communal consensus about how much dignity people are entitled to demand. And as sexual norms became more contested and as society became more egalitarian, juries were increasingly unwilling to reach a consensus about what kind of invasion, whether electronic or written, violated the standards of the ordinary reasonable person. The standard was it had to be highly offensive to a reasonable person, but that standard became increasingly difficult to apply, and reasonable people disagreed about what was highly offensive. So for that reason, there's a general consensus that the Brandeis torts, although a noble experiment, largely failed in America. There's a famous article that says the Brandeis torts are alive and well and living in France, where Princess Di and her heirs could refuse to allow her picture to be published in the newspaper because the aristocrats still can prevent themselves from being gossiped about. But in America, the whole effort to protect dignitary harms just didn't go over all that well in law. To comment, from my extremely limited experience, I have a very different approach. I took the title of my book on privacy, The Unwanted Gaze, from the doctrine of Hezek Re'ia, the injury caused by seeing or the injury caused by being seen. Even the smallest intrusion by the unwanted gaze causes injury, says the Talmud, because the injury caused by seeing cannot be measured. And that's why, as I understand it, forgive me and correct me if I'm misstating the authorities, if you enable to put up a window observing you in a common courtyard, not only does the window have to come down if you object, but it may have to come down even if you don't object, because you cannot alienate your right to dignity or privacy any more than you can sell your body into slavery or degrade yourself in other ways. Only when the tents of Israel face in opposite directions does the divine spirit dwell in Israel. So dignity in this Talmudic confession, as I understand it, is something of an inalienable right. One that can't be surrendered even if you choose to do it. It's kind of deeply legally enforced, and there's a much greater consensus about the prohibitions against its violation. So that's one conception of regulating gossip. It works in the Talmudic tradition. It's more problematic in the American tradition. Let's think of other American conceptions of privacy that might have some relevance to gossip. American law is much more comfortable with violations against liberty and autonomy than it is with violations against dignity. There's a wonderful article by James Whitman, a comparative scholar at Yale Law School, two conceptions of privacy, liberty versus dignity. And after tracing the fascinating evolution of dignitary privacy law in Europe, which incidentally has this weird twist, it used to be the case in Germany that only aristocrats could demand that their honor was legally enforced. And it was during the Nazi era that all members of the German Volk were entitled to demand the same respect that used to be limited to aristocrats. So that was the democratization of privacy that took place during the horrors of the Third Reich, but that survived in German law today. Nowadays, anyone can demand the honor that used to be limited to aristocrats, and if someone gives you a finger on the highway in Germany, you can immediately sue for a violation of honor. Imagine how that would fare in California. That's the story of dignity. America, the basis of privacy law is liberty. Our paradigmatic case of privacy invasion, the state breaking into your home and seizing your private papers. This is the story of John Wilkes, the famous British rogue parliamentarian who criticized King George's mother, because she was having an affair with Lord Bute, the foreign secretary, a truthful doctor, published anonymously in a pamphlet. King George determined to identify the author of the pamphlet, sent out his henchmen to break into the houses of all suspects, rummage through their desk drawers, identifying the author of this pamphlet, North Britain, 69. Eventually, they found Wilkes with the author by rummaging through his papers and seeing that he'd written the thing. he sued in trespass, because that was the doctrine that British law used to enforce liberty and privacy norms, and won a huge verdict, £1,000, a big amount of money for its day, a McDonald's-like verdict, on the grounds that paper searches for mere evidence were presumptively unreasonable according to common law. And this verdict was so famous that towns and children were named after the protagonists of the suit. Lord Camden and Squire Camden, New Jersey, Wilkes Barre, Pennsylvania. Every school child during our colonial era knew the story of John Wilkes, and that made clear that property-based protections for privacy, even in the face of an effort to enforce, to identify the authors of the Monmouth Gossip, would protect British and American citizens. But this is a limited protection for gossip that doesn't involve breaking into your home to identify the author. So if someone gossips about you in a newspaper or in a face-to-face situation, and the king or the president doesn't lodge a wiretap or try to invade the protected space, then private property-based trespass protections are not going to protect very much. And this was the problem that privacy confronted in this great Olmsted decision in the 1920s, an effort to enforce the prohibition, the predecessor of the war on drugs, the war on booze. The government had a suspected bootlegger. They put a wiretap under the sidewalk in front of his house. They identified him as a suspect. He sued. The majority of the Supreme Court said no trespass, no violation. They didn't have to break into his office. The wiretap is on the sidewalk, not in the home. Brandeis, in his visionary dissenting opinion, said, ways may someday be developed whereby it's possible to extract from secret desk drawers the intimate secrets of the home and introduce them in court. He's cyberspace. A far smaller invasion in the time of John Wilkes, he said, was considered a violation of liberty and transcend the Constitution to take account of this new technology. The court eventually came around to Brandeis' vision in the Taft case when it said that wiretaps without warrants that violate subjective expectations of privacy that people are prepared to accept as reasonable violate the Fourth Amendment, but the circularity of the test, namely as surveillance technology expands, people's expectations of privacy diminish in ways that diminish their constitutional protections. It made the test less than robust. And further, if we're talking about written gossip, truthful gossip, much of it began and disseminated not by means of surveillance, but by means of the newspaper and increasingly the internet. So to this degree, liberty and property, the core of American privacy protection, are not going to do much restriction of gossip. This leaves one third conception of privacy that's deeply relevant to our subject today. I've talked about two conceptions, dignity and autonomy. I now want to talk about the dangers of being judged out of context, which is a distinctive injury that gossip can inflict. It's exacerbated when private information is revealed, although it can also exist when public information is revealed. Let's think about what it means to be judged out of context on the basis, first, of private gossip. I became interested in this idea of being judged out of context because I started writing about privacy during the Clinton and Lewinsky scandal. And I was especially struck by the fact that Monica Lewinsky, long ago in the midst of the Clinton era, was most upset. Of all the privacy invasions she suffered, it wasn't the seizure of her dress from the DNA sample or the fact that her mother was asked to testify against her. It was the fact that her home computer was seized, the unsent love letters that she drafted but never mailed to Clinton were resurrected, but most forgivingly of all, her bookstore receipts were revealed. Why was Monica Lewinsky so upset by the revelation of her bookstore receipts? It wasn't that what she read was anything especially embarrassing or salacious. She read Vox, the book by Nicholson Baker. Vox is sort of a book about sex, but it's a highbrow book about sex. It's the kind of you might be happy to boast about to your friends, you know, to give a mild situation to seem slightly sophisticated. So why does she care? It's because she was judged out of context and misdefined. People thought of her as only the kind of ditzy woman who would read a sex book, but actually she was much more than that. Much all of us have many different complicated faces that we present to the world. We present one to our friends, and other to our spouses, and other to students. you're meeting me for the first time, and I'm talking to you about privacy, that I wear different masks in different contexts. This isn't false or inauthentic. It's what it means to be human. And Lewinsky, by having this one book, come to stand for all of her reading preferences, self-judged out of context. So that was my suggestion in this book on privacy. I was thrilled one day, soon after it came out, to get a call from a woman who said, "Jeff, this is Marsha Lewis, Monica's mother. I just want you to know we were so pleased with the book. We want to have a little dinner for you." So I met Monica Lewinsky, and she said, "That's exactly right. I felt judged out of context. People think I read the Dirty Box book. They don't know that I also read the complete works of Charles Dickens." And this one idea, especially because it's private, it's so hard to forget that the part comes to stand for the whole. It's the problem of the synecdoche, confusing the parts of the whole, and Lewinsky felt judged out of context because of this violation. Lewinsky was a long time ago, but I'm increasingly convinced that this problem of the synecdoche, the problem that Lewinsky experienced, is something that more and more of us experience in the age of Google and the Internet. As truthful gossip, that is, truthful revelation of private matters, is easy to put online and then hard to erase. So E.L. Goddard, in a famous essay on gossip, near the time that Brandeis published his famous essay, talked about the importance of the distinction between spoken and written gossip. Spoken gossip, though slanderous in the sense of being accurate, or even truthful but cruel, could be ignored. Even in a small community, if you weren't confronted face-to-face, people have short memories, they might be able to avoid having to respond to it. But Goddard worried that as tabloid newspapers were increasing and more gossip that used to be spoken was written, it became far more harmful of reputation because it demanded a public response and also was harder to escape. It could remain around forever. The Internet and Google have dramatically, tangibly increased this danger that Goddard described, both the acontextual judgment and also the impossibility of escaping the past, because if one truthful but embarrassing event is described online by a gossiper or by a journalist, it remains on Google and mystifying you for a long time, forever. So to take a simple example, my friend describes being set up on a blind date, and before the blind date she Googled the guy, as people do, and found he'd been described in an online magazine as one of the 10 worst dates of all time. So during their dinner, which was not their only dinner, she was unable to banish the details of his horrific insufficiencies that were kind of lurking around on Google. Now you could say this guy got what he deserved. He was not having a great, guy to go after dinner with. But maybe there was something disproportionate, Lewinsky-like, about the acontextual judgment he suffered. In the old days, she would call her friends, ask what this guy like. They might have said, watch out for him. She could have avoided him. But now, employers, future spouses, everyone can see this horrific deficiency which is lurking and they mystifying him for a long time. So far I've described the problem of gossip as the truthful reporting about private matters, talked about the danger of acontextual judgment, and especially because correcting the problem of the synecdoche generally requires the disclosure of more private information in order to put yourself in context. But in an age of limited attention span, you may not have a chance to be able to define yourself more fully. So an example that I'd like to give here, which shows us that the problem of being judged out of context is not only a problem of the revelation of private gossip or private information, you can also be judged out of context by the revelation of public gossip or public information. But the private information may be harder to put in a broader context. So here's the story. My friend and teacher, Lawrence Lessig, the guru of cyberspace, was appointed special master for the Microsoft case, which was being heard a couple years ago. And during the course of the litigation, it emerged that, according to Microsoft, he had downloaded a Microsoft Internet Explorer and then declared, "Sold my soul and nothing happened." People have been biased against Microsoft. But that's only part of the story. What actually transpired is that he had used Netscape as his browser, downloaded Internet Explorer because he wanted to enter a contest to win some sort of application. When he downloaded it, it erased all of his Netscape bookmarks, which he was really upset about. And then he was so frustrated that he quoted this Jill Sobule song that was playing on his iPod, or was recording out that on his car CD player, stole my phone. All right. So to tell you that story, it took me 20 seconds. But in age of short attention span, people have prospects. So they don't have time to quote Leslie more fully in context. They just have their memorable quote, just told my soul that nothing happened. To put himself in context, Leslie has to reveal more about his music preferences. He has to talk about what actually went on, his frustration. He has to reveal more private information. It's not that the original gossip was false. It was true. It was just incomplete. It's not that it related purely to private matters, because his partiality or impartiality as Microsoft's special master is a question of public concern, but the fact that he was misjudged on the basis of the private information made it harder to put into the board context. And I do think, in general, misjudgment on the basis of private information is harder to correct than the public misjudgment. So now let's think about other ways that we can be misjudged on the basis of truthful but harmful public, let's call it, information or gossip. I'm an author, and I write a book, and generally it gets good reviews, but it gets one terrible review, which is in a much more prominent place, and that tends to mystify it and goes on my Google record. Well, that's then digging beyond being judged out of context, but of course I can just write a better book or I can post to my better review, so there's some hope of a broader, more successful judgment. Or the football player, one way planning on who apparently took the ball and ran down the wrong end of the field and scored a goal for the wrong team. He was a great football player, but for the rest of his life, he was known as Ron Ray Diamond. Public misdeed. But still, he could try to put himself in context and say, well, I played these other games that were a little bit better. Or Lonnie Lanier, the Clinton nominee to be head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, who was misrepresented as a quota queen. She was never writing, she was something of the time. She was misrepresented by these implicit misreadings of her writing, but she didn't have time to put herself in context. These examples all go to show that the problem of acontextual judgment, which can result from gossip, is not distinctively a problem of privacy. It can be exacerbated by the revelation of public information, but I think it can be more harmful when the information is public. Okay, now let us begin to turn from an area, and there are other examples of the ways in which technology is exacerbating this problem with acontextual judgment. Some are public, some are private. I'm just going to give two more examples, and I want to turn to the Jewish sources. The gossip doesn't have to be written. There can be videos. So, for example, of acontextual judgment of private behavior, this is the example of the Star Wars kid, who you may remember was a young grade school kid who filmed himself on a video making dancing around his living room and making gestures with a golf ball. And some schoolmates found the video superimposed a Star Wars lightsaber on it, made him look ridiculous by dancing around with a lightsaber. The video went viral, and soon this kid indelibly known as a Star Wars kid, millions of people around the world know him this way. He's devastated, he gets to drop out of school, and feels that he's been judged out of context on the basis of this virtual gossip or pictures of this private behavior that was never meant to be made public. For an example of the public in contextual judgment, there's the dog poop girl. And I should say I'm getting these two examples from a group book called The Future of Reputation by my GW colleague Daniel Solov, who describes some of them. This is a woman in Japan who, I think, had not picked up after her dog. And this was photographed on a cell phone. She had the dog pooped on a subway. Photographed on a cell phone, posted on the net, went viral. She becomes the national pariah as the woman who violated this Japanese norm by not picking up after her dog and terribly harmed in all sorts of reputational ways. That behavior was public rather than private. But still acontextual and with a disproportionate sharing effect. All right. So, there is this problem with contextual judgment. It's exacerbated by the revelation of truthful private information. It can also take place through revelation of truthful public information, and it's harder and harder to escape in the age of the net and using. Now let's turn to the Jewish sources. My extremely cursory understanding of them, based on just the beginning of the study, is that the doctrine of Lashon Hara, according to Maimonides, Capital 9, here, Chapter 7, stresses that who the tale bearer was carries gossip going about from person to person and telling so-and-so said this, I've heard so-and-so about so-and-so. Even though he tells the truth, he ruins the world. There's a still worse iniquity that comes within this prohibition, namely the evil tongue of the scandalmonger, who speaks disparagingly of his fellow man, even if he tells the truth. And this is distinguished from people who disparage by telling lies, and it's called slander. And the question is this prohibition on truthful, disparaging gossip absolute? I gather no. You discussed in a previous lecture that there's a sort of public interest exception, and if it is felt that the revelation of this information is necessary to protect the public against the grave threat of safety, which might be interpreted more or less broadly as a threat to public integrity, then it may be possible to disclose the information. And how the line is drawn and who decides whether or not it's appropriate to disclose is a difficult question. The question you have asked me to discuss after setting out this comparison, because an introduction, is this prohibition on truthful, disparaging gossip consistent with a free press, with modern investigatory journalism, with modern opinion journalism, and with the First Amendment as American society understands it? And this is what we have to discuss again now. Broadly, of course, American law has been reluctant to prohibit the disclosure of truthful information on the grounds that it's a central concern to democratic discourse, especially in a society where people can only choose their leaders by having their strengths and weaknesses fully ventilated. Americans have repudiated the idea of seditious libel, namely that it's criminal to criticize leaders even if the gossip is true. Seditious libel embodied in the Alien and Sedition Acts, but heavily criticized by Thomas Jefferson and his Republican followers, was formally repudiated at last in the New York Times versus Sullivan, which said that it had not withstood the test of history, and Sullivan set out the test that said that when it comes to truthful criticism of public figures, the speech cannot be banned unless it is both false and published negligently, defined as with reckless disregard for the truth. So that essentially cuts off the discussion of the public source advice and says that truthful gossip, even if disparaging, of public figures cannot be banned. It's protected by the First Amendment. So as a descriptive matter, we say that American law takes a very different approach than the Talmud and has set the bar on the side of protecting speech rather than protecting dignity and protecting people from being judged out of context. But I think what we want to ask together now is it possible for journalists to respect the Talmudic injunctions and still perform his or her functions as a journalist in calling leaders to account, in discussing topics of public importance? Is there any way to reconcile these two imperatives? So let's ease into this with a few examples. At this point, I'm going to thank you very much for the public session of this lecture, and with your